Hey everybody. First things first, I wanted to thank Tom LaPlage for this new intro music. This track's called Breaking Up Song, and it's from Tom's musical project called Tom Tom. Check that out on SoundCloud. Follow him on Twitter too at SciPilot, SIGHPILOT. He makes me laugh 2-3 times a day at a bare minimum, so it's very refreshing to have that on the old timeline. And thanks everyone else who reached out to help me with my intro music debacle, maintenance phase, drop the lawsuit, I am free. Anyway, today's guest is Otessa Moshfegh. She doesn't need too much of an introduction, I'd imagine, but just in case, Otessa is a fiction writer originally from New England. Her books include Eileen, which is her first novel. It was shortlisted for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Man Booker Prize, and it won the Penn Hemingway Award for debut fiction. My Year of Rest and Relaxation, which was a New York Times bestseller, and her latest book, Death in Her Hands, which was also a New York Times bestseller. She's also the author of a short story collection called Homesick for Another World and a novella titled Migloo. And for your information, Death in Her Hands will be coming out in paperback in June, just a few weeks away. So look out for that. It's very much worth the read. And all right, here we go.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thanks so much again. I'm a huge fan of your work, and everybody that I've been interviewing and stuff, when I told them I was having you on, they were all quite excited. So, but before we get into all that, I want to ask you about Gary-Elle Lutz, because I had this wonderful conversation with her, and she sort of told me how, like, pretty early on in your career, you might have been in high school still, you had reached out to Gary-Elle, formerly Gary, to talk about writing or something, and then I had read the complete Gary Lutz and saw that you'd given a nice blurb, and I was just really curious about, you know, how you came to know one another.
I had been reading then Gary Lutz's work, yeah, since high school. I mean, I was born in 1981, and Gary's work had been in the Quarterly, and I think Stories in the Worst Way had come out, and I was just all about it. Like, those early stories made an enormous impression on me. And then I happened to meet a mutual friend and got an address and sent a letter, which I'm sure was really weird because at the time I was like, I don't know, maybe I was like 19 and in college. And then I got a letter back, and then we traded email addresses, and then we just became friends over email, which, you know, was really novel at the time. It was, yeah, like, you know, 1999 or 2000, something like that. And yeah, and then we ended up hanging out a couple of times in New York, and have just kept in touch. And I haven't seen Gary-Elle as Gary-Elle. I'm really happy for her and really, really curious about what happens next with her work. And mm-hmm. I just think the most of her. And yeah, that's kind of all I can really tell you.
That's cool. It's almost like when you read her for the first time, I feel like you can never write a sentence or try to write a sentence the same way ever again.
There was a period where I was corresponding with her a lot, and she was teaching, don't quote me on this, but I think it was something like technical writing at a university in Pennsylvania. And she shared with me some document that she had given her students, and it was like about grammar. And I had never considered grammar in that kind of rigorous, like, crystal way before. And it really, really made an impression. And I think for years I was sort of obsessed with grammar in a Lutzian way, and it definitely informed, like, what would later become my short story writing style. I mean, there's, like, you know, attention to language in a particular way. I mean, I know every writer pays attention to language, but there's something about the way Lutz was writing. I mean, a lot of writers in the Quarterly, like, influenced by Gordon Lish, and then coming through like the 21st century, seeing how those modes sort of like influenced the next generation, I felt sort of not like I was in a movement per se, but riding some kind of wave where, I mean, the fiction is sort of, I mean, it's sort of radical because it isn't about issues, you know, it's not about like social politics du jour, which I think is something that like, you know, commercially works really well in literature. And I have no problem with it, but it just hasn't been my interest.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're not, your work is not like that at all. I mean, you're never topical. It's always coming from a strange place, I think.
No. In fact, like, it didn't even occur to me that that was a thing until Eileen was on the market looking for an editor. And I was having conversations with editors who were talking about, like, well, what is this? Like, what's the pitch, you know? And I was like, you know, totally taken aback, but like very willing to roll with it for the sake of my own career. You know, it wasn't like it was going to change the book.
Right.
You know, I wasn't going to change the book, but if people need me, my help labeling what it is, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's not so much to ask.
Did you come up with like a helpful label when you had to give these elevator pitches?
I fucking it's don't been, remember. Yeah. I'm sure it wasn't actually very helpful. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, like, I feel really, really lucky that I'm able to have a career when I've been so sort of opposed to everything that goes into being a writer with a career. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a little bit like eating my own bullshit here, because I make I accommodate the capitalistic system by publishing into a system. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not like Xeroxing my own books in the basement, but I want to feel like I am. Like, I want to feel like I'm that committed to my work and would sacrifice everything for it. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit still sort of confused.
Maybe you're just like a necessary
labeling.
Yeah. Maybe you're just like a necessary countermeasure to the overtly political stuff that's coming out now. I don't know.
You know, it's so funny because my husband, Luke Goebel, who's also a novelist and screenwriter, is so much more aware of like what is happening in the publishing industry. Like I'm constantly taken aback by the fact that like things have moved forward.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've been moving backwards. Like the last book I wrote went all the way back to like the late Middle Ages. So I'm trying to get, I mean, the COVID year and thinking about modernity is actually like a futuristic realm that is devoid of human contact and like all that kind of stuff really made me want to go like deep past. And I guess that prohibited me from really needing to know what is going on in books.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are you reading, Otessa? And I'm like, a book about trees. I don't know.
Yeah, one of the oldest things I could find to read about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had heard through the grapevine that, and I want to talk about all your stuff, but I heard through the grapevine that something you wrote over COVID is, yes, like it's medieval, but it's also might have some magic in there. It seems kind of like something new for you, it seems like you're always drastically changing yourself between novels, but I just wanted to confirm A, that was true. I'd only heard it, someone told me that, but B, if that is true, what that's been like.
Well, I don't know if I'd use the label of magic, but the book certainly has some folklorish elements and characters and is most importantly, a book about different relationships with God, I guess.
Yeah.
I haven't done the elevator pitch for this book yet, so, you know, it's a lot of things to me, but it was really a deeply, like a investigation of how spirituality functions in society for me. Not for me, I mean, like, in my observation, as I've observed those things, and how necessary it is, like, how necessary faith is when one is going through a crisis, like, you know, COVID or the climate change, or, you know, any of those huge things that's happening all the time that is impossible to think about and contain oneself about. And like, we need something bigger outside of ourselves too.
And so why the 13th?
Have faith in.
Yeah. Why the, why medieval times? Why then, if to explore this kind of idea?
It's just the world that developed, around the story I wanted to tell. And the kind of characters I wanted to coexist in this world could only exist in a time that to us right now feels sort of timeless. The way that the Middle Ages or like the medieval period work, at least in my imagination, is like this netherworld, you know, where it's like a combination of like innocence and good and evil, and like, you know, these basic storytelling strategic realms, in a world that's dissimilar from ours, but also completely, in our minds, like comprehensible, because it seems so simple, but it's actually not. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I could be justifying any decision, but it just, like, the Middle Ages came to mind, and I think partly it was probably influenced a bit by the isolation of this year, and the place I was quarantining in was my house, which is essentially like built out of church stones.
Oh wow.
It's built by this guy like 100 years ago, and he used a lot of found materials, and a lot of the materials that he used were from like the, can't remember if it was San Diego or Santa Barbara, but basically this mission that had been destroyed in an earthquake. He just like went back and forth with his truck and like loaded up, built this house. I mean, he got stones from all over the Southwest and Mexico and stuff, but the churchiness of this house, I think, made an impression.
Yeah. Like, your environment kind of bleeds into it. And I think I read in Baum, or maybe, I don't know, somewhere else about, which I really respected, but you were kind of talking about how, like, when you write settings, you, if you want to write about a building or something, you only want to see the edge of it, and then you want to make the rest of the building up in your mind. But I think that's cool, because I think if I were to try to write something in the Middle Ages, I'd be so in my own head about, like, what does it look like and what did people wear? And I don't want some fact checker to tell me that I was wrong and stuff. So how do you kind of, like, did you do a lot of research about in this book about like how the world was then? Or is it kind of just sort of from that imaginary place that we all kind of have about the Middle Ages?
I think, I mean, mostly the latter, but I bought hundreds of books thinking that I would research the hell out of this. And it turned out that I learned something really important, and that was to create a convincing world. Like, you don't need everything. Like, you only need to keep track of the most important, most interesting and telling details of the world as observed by a character. So, like, you know, one of my characters is a lamb herder, so I had to learn about sheep. You know, one of my characters has this sort of what people are calling magical ability to understand birdsong. So I looked into birds. I needed to know like how a medieval village was set up, and I kind of, you know, picked and chose what details about, you know, the that system I wanted to make use of, and you know, stuff like that. It was sort of on an as needed basis. I didn't want the research to slow me down.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think I think it's probably a good opportunity too to talk about, I guess, where you started. I mean, I know you started as a kid. Like you knew you wanted to be a writer pretty young, right?
Yeah, I think I knew when I was 14. That's when I like really was like, this is what I want.
You would just like reach out to writers that you admired, and because people seem pretty receptive to like talking to you and hanging out with you in New York and showing you how things worked.
I don't know. My sister gave me some advice once, and it was to seek out the people and experiences that are going to help you live the life that you want. And so I've never really been shy about contacting people. I mean, maybe it's because I'm like, haven't been properly socialized either. I'm not great at making friends or having like chit chat at the dog park. Like it's always awkward.
You get a dog or do you have a dog?
I have two dogs and we're about to get two more. Yeah, dogs. I dedicated my last book to my dog. His name is Walter.
Walter? That's a great name. We are about to get a dog, and I like the human names. We're naming ours Henry, so it'll be
I know my sister has a dog named Henry.
Oh really? I thought it was
He's very grouchy. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't become like a grouchy old man. I hope he doesn't become his name, you know. Yeah.
Well, you could call him Hank, and then he could have like so this like innocent swagger.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so it's cool that you started young, and I know you're writing a lot of short stories, and we don't have to go all over all that, but I guess I'm really, one of the reasons I'm really interested in your writing is just how, I don't know if you get bored with sameness or something, but how every book is just so like radically different, both in subject matter and time period, but like also the characters. And I guess McGlue to me is so much different than anything else that you've done. And I know that you were in an MFA program, right, when you were writing it?
Is that true?
Yeah. And so I'm in one, and a lot of people who listen to this are in one. And it's you've said a lot of interesting stuff in the past about MFA programs, like trying how you kind of are forced to either be radical or to submit writer the same or something like that. So but McGlue to me seems radical. And I'm just kind of wondering like if you could take me back to the time when McGlue was happening.
Well, I mean, I went to one MFA program, and I don't know how much it's safe to generalize about all MFA programs based on my experience, but I went to Brown, and everyone in my class was doing something completely different, very experimental. So I was the one amongst my year that was doing like that was writing narrative. To be honest, I mean, everyone's work was so out there, like, you know, really reaching for the edges of what was possible. Mark Bommer, who was an incredible writer and videographer and activist, was in my year. Who else was in my year? Well, everyone went on to do very different things.
Yeah.
So it was a cool space. And I guess when you feel jammed in with a bunch of weirdos, like you need to express yourself, you have like way more room to be weird. And I don't think I would have, I wouldn't have written McGlue if I hadn't gone to the library out of boredom one day, like between classes or just like trying to kill time because I was like sad and lonely or something. And found this article in Nexus, Plexus, Lexus or whatever the newspaper database is. It was an article from a newspaper in New England in 1850, And it was just this little article about the outcome of a trial in which this guy, McGlue, was convicted, or actually was acquitted on the count of murder. He was tried for murder and acquitted.
His real name is McGlue?
Yeah.
No, that's awesome.
And the guy that he killed really was named Johnson. And McGlue was from Salem. McGlue was from Salem, and he really did kill Johnson in the port of Zanzibar and really did get off on account of being like a crazy drunk and in a blackout and having suffered brain damage from jumping off a moving train.
So you're almost like the book writes itself here now.
It was like that. I was like, oh, there's the entire book.
Yeah.
That like article that was maybe four sentences, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing that. I think I wrote like the first half of my first year and then took a break and then went back to it to finish it. And finishing it was really hard.
In terms of like editing or just kind of figuring out how it was going to end?
Figuring out how it was going to end. Like, I always knew it would be somehow like a perfect circle. I mean, not that it was perfect, but that just that it would come back to its beginning because of the structure of the storytelling. But it's so weirdly jagged and operates in a logic that was sort of painful to occupy as a writer. Like, I was really happy when it was over. I mean, not happy. I was relieved.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was happy at all back then. But yeah, I mean, I remember writing that book. Mm-hmm. I remember writing that book. I remember writing every book. What am I saying?
But yeah, that's
It's
your first. So, but it's interesting because you've said about other books that it was almost like a death once you finished it, right? Like it was sad, made you sad. So you were happy. You're happy to get rid of McGlue.
And maybe I was. I'm happy now that I'm not writing it.
Yeah.
I don't think I could. Like, I think I don't even know if I'm capable. I would be capable of conjuring that voice again.
Yeah, conjuring's like an interesting word though, because. You know, you're pretty much your first person all the way, but all of your first person narrators are so radically different from one another. And I without having ever met you before, I was like, she must be a method actor or something, like the method actor version of writing, where like you really channel or get into the sort of headspace that's like necessary for each of these characters. And I wonder, like, does it take a toll on you? Like, did Eileen take a toll on you, or McGlue, or the narrator in My Year of Rest and Relaxation? Were you kind of like, did you find parts of yourself sort of becoming them and vice versa?
Well, first of all, you're totally right. I mean, the way that I think about narrative is really like the way one would think about monologue. And I used, when I was writing McGlue, I wrote with this big mirror behind my computer so that I could like kind of like look up and like test out or just observe myself having become this character. Like, it was, is there anything that I can glean from like this posture or this look in my eye or whatever? Not in a narcissistic way, but in a method acting way. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, I'm not a good actor. I cannot act. But when I'm writing, I am attempting to become somebody else and speak through them and also have them speak through me. So, yeah, I mean, writing is both fuel and the expenditure of energy, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, so I don't think I break even. I mean, I think, everything that I've done has been net positive for me in my life. Like, I've learned, like, I have become bigger and more expanded with everything that I've written, simply because I had to learn how to write the thing. So I had to get smarter about how I wanted to write. Well, you know, like, Eileen didn't disturb me at all. Like, I actually thought she was pretty, like, manageable. When people were so disturbed.
Yeah, I thought she was really like funny and I read something about how that she, oh, like she detests her body or something. And I was like, I don't think it was really that. I thought it was more like a, anyway, I thought she was more funny than disturbed, but I didn't want to. Do you feel that like, that people, do you feel that your protagonists are like necessarily sad or, because I find a lot of your work to be like deeply funny. And I don't know if you feel the same way, like if you feel more pity for Eileen than you find her to be this kind of like dark but comical character.
I mean,
like, do you laugh when you're writing scenes ever?
Sometimes.
Okay, that's what
I was. Sometimes. Yeah. I would laugh. I mean, some of my short stories, there were like certain lines of dialogue that I just like couldn't help but laugh at because they were so ridiculous. But I mean, it's funny because I don't, because I'm on the inside writing out, I'm not sort of classifying how I see my characters or what I think about them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just existing in the world that they exist in. And if they are existing in a world that has satirical humor, then I'm in that water. And I'm not really like naming it all the time. I'm just like, that's the world I'm in. Mm-hmm. I think I find it really hard to be like completely self-serious. Like every time I attempt to, I end up reading back what I've written and I'm like, oh my God, that is totally over the top.
Yeah.
Like I have like a disability around complete sincerity. Which I'm like learning to accept as like a stylistic aspect of my writing character, like the character of myself as a writer. But in this book that I just finished, the medieval one, I set out to write a book that was not in the first person. I was like, I need
to be in the first
person. And I really loved it.
Wow.
It was like a relief, like someone had let me out of a room, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, I was going to ask you like when you chose to do one versus the other, but like that's so cool. I mean, that's another example, I feel like, of you challenging yourself. But what was freeing about it?
That I could explore multiple points of view.
Mm-hmm.
That I could make decisions based on the larger story that I was telling rather than make decisions based on an exploration of one character's interiority.
Mm.
It was like the difference between writing, let's see, like painting a self-portrait from a photograph. No, I can't even do it. Like, forget that. It was just, I felt like I was free to roam. And that was scary for me because I had gotten so used to writing in one voice. And that voice was the storyteller telling the story of that voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scared that like I wouldn't know how to tell a story any other way, but I managed to reach the end of the book, so that was a good exercise. And not do that, you know. There is no I. There's like one moment in the book where the narrator makes a comment or asks a question, like toward the very end of the book. So that was me sort of like discovering what a third person narrator could do, or pushing at that a bit.
Yeah. What was the hardest part about making the switch? I think I would probably over describe maybe like details if I was writing in the third person or something had I been writing in the first before that. But was there any particularly difficult thing that you remember?
I mean, I think the difficult thing was learning to trust my instincts. I mean, I know logically that I need to do that, so I did it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was always like, can I really move, like make this leap now? Like, am I going to lose the story moving from this point of view to another point of view, it really felt like I had switched systems, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe there was some innocence around that that allowed me to do it without overthinking. Yeah, I think that was probably the hardest part.
Mm. Can you tell us anything about like who the narrator in this book is, or the hero, the protagonist?
Oh, I guess if there was a main character, it's a pretty decent sized cast of characters.
Cool.
And the maybe if I had to pick like who was the main character, it would be this like adolescent boy named Marek, whose father is the lamb herder.
Okay.
He's just really strange. He's, I don't know how much I could say, but he ends up like living out his karma in a way that you really don't see coming. Like I didn't see it coming. I mean, I had it planned out to an extent, but you can never plan out the things that surprise you, you know?
I guess since we're talking about, there's not a main character here, so you had to write in a lot of different voices, and we were talking about your method acting and stuff, but did you have to just get in the heads of dozens of people, or was it more, you don't have to go so far into the interior when you're doing third person that you don't have to like lose your mind method acting for 12 roles?
Yeah, I mean, it was really only like eight to 10 characters. No, I didn't lose my mind. There was a sense that the book was my salvation during this year. Like I was counting on it spiritually and psychologically to be my escape.
Yeah.
From the day-to-day terror and all of the mundane repetitions.
Yeah.
So like I had a hopefulness about the book. I was like, this is a gift. And an opening. I don't remember what your question was now.
Yeah, I was just basically like talking about, you know, getting into character when you're doing this first person stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know. It's like, I think a lot about my year of rest and relaxation, and maybe like a couple questions about my year of rest and relaxation. First is like, the book is essentially about somebody who, I mean, the book is about someone who's trying to like not exist for a time, like to be, not be conscious and to be asleep. And that immediately would scare the shit out of me if I was like, I'm going to try to write an interesting book about people. I don't know. Like, how did you make a story interesting when it's about someone just trying to be asleep?
Well, I mean, I think the important question is about the trying to be asleep, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the sleep itself can have some meaning, I guess, but it's all about the journey of effort made toward getting there. And I think that's like, that's true about, maybe that's just how I see what stories are. It's like someone trying.
like someone trying to get somewhere, failing on some level and overcoming.
Yeah. Like even if it's like, oh, I'm just trying to live a normal day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, then if you're telling that story, something weird's probably going to happen today.
Mm-hmm. You find a way to tell stories in which like, in the framework of something that would almost seem like, I don't know, an anti-story or something if you were to give an elevator pitch. But the other thing about my rest and my year of rest and relaxation is how, for the most part, it's like it's indoors. It's inside of an apartment. And that's interesting to me because I would imagine that was quite challenging in terms of like, I don't know, not being able really to rely on setting too much.
Or maybe it was really appropriate because I could rely on the setting. Like the setting was totally stable. I mean, it's always weird to go back and look at things that way, because the story wouldn't be the story that it is if it was always leaving the apartment.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she does leave the apartment.
So yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
But it's not a portrait of New York, you know?
Right.
It's the most we see of the outside world is that weird park yeah. on the East River.
And the bodega.
And the bodega, yeah.
Did you, how long did you live in New York?
I lived in New York. I moved to New York when I was 17, and I think I left when I was 27. But for a couple of those years, I lived somewhere else. So like 8 or 9 years.
Okay. And you have interesting feelings about leaving, right? Like, I think, how'd you feel by the end of your stint here?
God, I can barely remember it. I was excited to be moving on with my life.
Yeah.
I was also really ill when I decided to leave New York. Like, I couldn't. It's not like I was a party person. I wasn't. I was actually like mostly a very boring, sober person. But the lifestyle, I don't think I could ever live in New York again. I just couldn't. But partially because, like, this illness that I had kind of changed me and, like, changed time, like, changed my general energy level. And,
what was it? We don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, but what was the illness?
It's called cat scratch disease, and it basically attacks your nervous system. So I was in a real, like, it was like being on drugs for like a year and a half. Like not like a great trip. Like the worst part of the trip where you're like twitching on the bed. Yeah, so that was kind of the end. And yeah, I mean, it was also like, okay, this feeling of like, I've done my time, which is totally delusional, because there is no time to do. But I definitely think if you live in New York in your early, middle 20s, like, you get jaded, which I think is sort of advantageous, and that, like, you're not so easily impressed by just whatever.
Yeah.
And you also have, I mean, it depends on what, like, community sort of circle, but I feel like I had some sense of what was going on. Whereas living in LA, I have, like, no sense of what's going on. Like, every time I go to New York, I mean, it's different, because last time I went to New York was a couple weeks ago, and it was not like this. But usually when I would go to New York to visit, I would feel like I was getting off a bus from Arkansas, you know, like, oh my God, this is what people are wearing now. Like, this is how, this is the consciousness. Whoa. Like, I have been living in a field.
Yeah.
but
it probably did that. I mean, that must have, like, based on what you've been saying about just kind of like going back and in time and your writing, or I guess like not writing about the here and now, is like, I wonder if leaving New York was helpful for you on some level.
Oh, it definitely was.
Yeah.
I don't think I could write in New York. I mean, it's just, there's so many minds collected in one place, overlapping mind space. It's just like, I don't think I know how to say anything original or authentic.
Yeah, in New York or on Twitter, which I don't think you have a Twitter, by the way, do you?
No, I don't. I had Twitter. I had a Twitter, like, at one point, but I didn't really use it for anything real.
Yeah. So you wrote Eileen. Then was that out? You were out in L.A.
Yeah, I was living in L.A.
I hate to ask you the question that everybody asks you, but I actually don't know the answer. Is I've heard varying forms of, like, in writing Eileen, you set out to do a very specific thing, which was, like, write maybe something more along the lines of like a thriller or something with a plot, basically.
Yeah.
And I was just talking to one of my professors about how I'm kind of like, I just like recently stumbled upon a thriller and I was like, this would be cool to try one day. And I kind of would love to know about what that process was like. And was that fun? Was it hard to be like, okay, so this is going to follow, like, there will be this kind of like climax that involves action and a murder, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. It was, I actually don't think I've been so uptight and nervous about writing as I was writing Eileen, because I felt like I had taken on this experiment to completely go against everything that I had been training myself to do as a writer, which was to, write a book in which conventions are followed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, yeah, it was fun. It was fun. And I don't know why. I was like terrified. I was terrified writing that book because I was making like $18 an hour in a part-time job. Like, I moved to LA. I could not find a job. Like, hand to God, I probably like applied to like 10 jobs a day.
Wow. What were you looking for? You were in publishing before, right? Or was it something else?
I had worked for a publishing company in production for a couple of years. Okay. And I had been like an assistant to an author. And then I had gone to grad school and came away with a master's in fine arts and writing, and then moved to LA with really no plan. I knew that I needed to sort of get away from my homeland of mm-hmm. the Northeast and try to live a life where, you know, I didn't have to depend on an institution or anyone else, and in New York being like one of those institutions.
Yeah.
So I was just broke. Like, I was broke, and I was writing short stories, and they hadn't gotten published. I mean, I hadn't made any money as a writer.
Yeah, I mean.
And I just got really real with myself. I remember I asked my dad to loan me $1,000. And I was like, I think I said something like, can I borrow $1,000? Like, I'll pay you back. Because I like couldn't pay rent.
Yeah.
And like gas was so expensive, you know, like, and I was like, I'm going to try to write a book that I could potentially publish. And if it doesn't work, I don't know, maybe I'll go to grad school or something. Maybe I'll go to law school.
Ah.
You know, I was just like, this, like, how am I ever going to make it? Like, I had, both of my parents are musicians, and I watched them struggle.
Yeah.
I mean, they made their living teaching, and I really didn't want to be part of academia. Like, I had had a lot of experience with academia, and I just knew it would never make me, I would never be feel free or happy or even useful in mm-hmm. that arena. So I was like, okay, like, what do people, like, what is a book? And like, I instantly thought of Agatha Christie. I mean, just like as an aside, like, I had already been writing for 15 years or whatever.
Yeah.
I was already totally committed to being a writer, but I had never thought of myself as a novelist. And for me, like, a novel was a very trite thing. Like, I didn't have respect for it in the way that I didn't know. It's not that I didn't have respect for the novel. It's that I never related to it to a novelist. Like, I was like, I could never do that. It's so different from the deal that I am supposed to do, which is write these sort of experimental fictions.
Like shorter, like short stories, yeah.
Yeah, and like McGlue as like a kind of another version of an mm-hmm. experimental fiction. So I was like, okay, I have no idea. Despite having like concentrated in creative writing in college, like read everything that I could get my hands on, gone to graduate school for writing. Like, I had no idea what a how plot functioned in the human psyche,
mm-hmm.
or how to structure a novel. I was like, okay, I admit that I am completely ignorant. And of course, that wasn't really true. Like, what I discovered in writing Eileen was that it's in storytelling and all of the things that people like go and dissect, like three act, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all so fucking intrinsic to the way that we tell stories. You know, we just like listen to someone tell a good story. There's a rhythm to it.
Yeah.
There and like, you know, you have an experience listening to it that follows a certain, like, yeah, the beginning, you're like drawn in, and then things get complicated and you're like thinking more. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot on the line and you're getting excited and what's going to happen. And then something happens and you're like, whoa, what the fuck am I now? And that's basically it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And we've all heard, like, since we were able to understand English or any language, like, we've all heard great stories since we were little. And it's almost like you have to learn to forget about, I don't know, whatever you're trying to do, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's weird because in a way, one could tell themselves, oh, it's so much easier than you think. But yeah. Then when you start doing it, you're like, oh, no, this is... Once you get past that, mm-hmm. it's very difficult.
I bet. I'm personally, I have no idea how I would ever go from short fiction to something longer. It seems just like that will never mm-hmm. happen. But yeah, so then what were some of your resources? Like, were you reading Agatha Christie or were you reading like thrillers and trying to figure out? No, you just were like...
I wasn't reading anything except for this book called The 90-Day Novel.
Oh, really?
Which is a like... technique for drafting a novel in 90 days where you spend the first 30 days with like you start the process with zero idea and for 30 days you're just like free writing answering questions and exploring like what comes to you.
I'm writing this down, by the way.
Just order the 90-day novel.
Yeah, that's like, what I mean. I'm ready on it, so I don't forget. I have a terrible memory. Okay, cool.
And then I kind of that was cool. Like I'd never done anything like that before, mm-hmm. and it did show me that there was like the story for Eileen like already existed inside of me. Like mm-hmm. I was just accessing it through sort of letting go and like letting myself write into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being really sloppy.
Yeah.
It was really liberating. I kind of abandoned the method of the 90-day novel after the first 30 days because basically you leave the first 30 days with a plot outline and then you just have to write it. Like, and you're supposed to like write a certain number of words every day for 60 days. So I had like a word count goal every day and I wrote really quickly.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where I learned to write really quickly in drafting, which has been really helpful to me. Because not having the ability to write quickly and badly, it will take you forever. Like it would take me so long to write a novel that I would give up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting that you write quickly. Will you just sit down? I mean, do you give yourself like what's your routine now? Do you give yourself like a word count or do you like, will you sit down even if you don't have an idea and just try to like pump out 500 words and see what happens?
No, I don't ever really write without purpose,
mm-hmm.
but I do, like when I'm trying to understand the novel, or like I'm working, I have to get back to this novel that I have put on pause for 2 years. And I know that there will be a lot of note-taking and like processing about where I need to go from where I left it.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Are you going to give yourself a break, a little break here now that you've just finished something?
Well, I have kind of been on hiatus for the past several weeks. Not because I finished the book, but because I otherwise work in film.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And yeah, I'm just in this very strange new place of being like everything that I've been doing has been put on pause at the same moment.
Oh. Are you screenwriting or is it something else?
Yeah.
Okay.
Writing scripts.
Do you like it?
I enjoy it. And it feels like extra.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I can write a novel, if I can write the novels that I want to write and then fill my time with fun things like writing movies, like,
yeah.
Fuck yeah, I'll do that.
Have you finished a movie yet?
Nothing that I've written has been released.
Okay.
So, you know, not exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds so fun, though. And it's probably like, I don't know, screenwriting is probably very difficult, but do you think that's something you'll like lean into and keep doing is screenwriting? Or
yeah, either that or like quit altogether and never watch or do anything film related ever again. But no, yes. I think it's something I'll keep doing.
That's very cool. Well, I hope that something you write is released soon. And I know someone's going to make a movie out of Eileen, right?
Actually, my husband and I co-wrote an adaptation and it will be hopefully shot next winter.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I have I wanted to tell you too that my mother was born in Croatia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I saw that about you, and my mom was born in Split.
I love Split.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't been there in like over 10 years, but yeah, I love Split.
Where, it's just your mom's from there, right?
Uh-huh.
And where's she from in Croatia?
Mostly she lived in Zagreb.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, my uncle was born there too. Croatia's pretty awesome. I don't know how much you speak.
No, not really. Do you?
No, like just like swear words and you know the basics.
Like what?
Oh, like
Isuse se Bože. That's all I can say.
What swear word is that?
It's not a swear. It's just like an exclamation. Isuse se Bože. It just means like Jesus God.
Yeah, like all their insults and exclamations have a lot to do with Jesus.
Yeah,
it's kind of fun. I don't know, just the basics. I know Magarac, my grandpa would always call me a Magarac, which means jackass. Or donkey, depending
on. Do you still have family in Croatia?
Yeah, like everyone. My mom's moving.
That's awesome.
My mom just got a place there. My grandma's moving back from Cleveland to Croatia. So just got my citizenship through her, which is exciting. So I might go.
Oh, my God. I'm gonna hit you up and ask you how you did that later.
Yeah, it's really complicated, but only because bureaucracy in Croatia is unimaginable. I called the guy once because I needed to pick up my passport, and I could tell he was still in his bed, and he was supposed to be he was supposed to be like at the consulate ready to meet me. What? I'll be there. I'm coming. I'm like, all right.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, but yeah, if you ever need some guidance, we didn't really talk about Death in Her Hands too much, but I guess a personal question is just, I have a friend and someone I interviewed in the past, Shai Watson, was kind of talking about like how maybe this, like there's increasingly maybe a spirituality element in your stories or, you know, we were talking about it earlier, like this concept of channeling characters, whether you want to call it method acting or something, or channeling something else. But I was just kind of wondering personally, like, you know, I kind of find myself on that sort of journey, and I was wondering like how spirituality has sort of tracked with your career. Or we started off, I think, talking about new book being about your one's relationship to God or the many relationships to God. But
I mean, it becomes more and more obvious to me that God is real.
Yeah.
in all of the ways that sentence is bizarre to me, it feels true. It's something that I find difficult to talk about, and maybe that's why I write about it, mm-hmm. Or write because of it. I don't know. I mean, I think that every year I have more faith in something because I feel like I've experienced one more year with it. And I think about it a lot.
Yeah, same here.
Like I think about existence a lot, and you know, what it means to be a soul and what happens when we die. I mean, like all that basic stuff that I don't know. I was talking to someone yesterday and they like didn't know what I was talking about. They were like, oh yeah, spirituality, that's like Christian or something. I was like, it can be, totally. But it was like they thought that God was only for people of religious faith. Like of, you know, institutionalized religious faith. And that was weird. I was really surprised by that. Weird.
I don't know. Maybe they just assume that you need some sort of doctrine in order to even have the belief in the first place. But
yeah, or maybe they just feel super comfortable being alive, so they don't ever question beyond that.
Yeah, yeah, that's something else. You know, not to make you uncomfortable, but that I just about you as a writer and an author is just like there's so much like ironic cynicism and stuff, especially around. In the modern publishing world or something, it's just kind of refreshing to have someone so open about like the questions that all of us are carrying around, mm-hmm. whether we really know it or not. Like no one wants to talk about that kind of stuff, even though I don't know how people aren't thinking about it all the time, but they aren't.
Well, maybe that's what technology is for, is to hypnotize you away from those big questions so that you'll, you know, spend money and make money.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe so. But I don't know. It makes me very happy to hear that that's something you're thinking about and that you're gonna keep writing and making movies one day, and I'll be able to kind of explore that my existential concerns through your work.
So if you're half Croatian, what's your other half?
My dad's Irish.
Cool. I feel a tremendous bond with people who are half Croatian, especially someone who has a Croatian mother.
Yeah? Why is that?
Because it's rare.
Yeah.
Like my mother's always saying, like, Croatians are special. There are so few of them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a small country that is really full of itself.
oh my God. I kind of love it, but it is. Yeah. It's such a strange place, but they are like lovely people. And I do sometimes feel like pretty, yeah, we're rare, you know?
Yeah. No, it does feel rare.
Yeah.
I'll be curious to hear from you, like how it feels now that you have your citizenship. To go back there.
But yeah, I'll definitely let you know.
Yeah. And I will be hitting you up about all the bureaucracy.
Yeah, please do. Please do. No, I appreciate it. It was really great talking to you. And I hope we can keep in touch. And I had one other person on Twitter ask me if you would help them pick a name for their kitten.
Oh, how cute.
So
I have a name.
Okay, well...
Oh, show me the kitten.
She has two. She picked two and she wanted your preference. But so this is AJ, Alex, Beth, Juarez, and this is the kitten.
Wow.
And the names that they had come up with were either Flan or Honey.
Well, the name that I was thinking was Reality.
Reality?
Isn't that a good cat name?
Especially with these eyes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a gorgeous cat.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Reality? I'll just tell them Reality and they can.
Yeah.
Yeah. That should be enough. They should just ditch Flan and Honey and just do Reality.
Those aren't good names. I mean, Honey is okay, but that looks like a special cat.
Yeah, doesn't it? It does. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Well, I'll make sure to let them know to just ditch. It was really fun to meet you and glad Likewise. You're doing well. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah. Great to meet you.
Great to meet you. I'll talk to you
Take
soon.
Take care. Yep. Bye. Bye.
All right, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to that conversation with Otessa Moshfegh. We have some great guests coming up. Darren Strauss, Big Bruiser Dope Boy, Gerald Brennan, and more. So thanks so much for your support, and we'll talk to you next time.